From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
They've been promoting the book in Canada a little early because evidently every vegetable recipe in the book is a good candidate for a Thanksgiving table.
It's true. I've been talking to chef, author, and New York Times columnist David Tanis. In his new book, Market Cooking, David takes us through the farmer's market for inspiration. And since few meals are as season-dependent as Thanksgiving, I've been hitting him up for ideas, especially for sides. Okay, so what I want to start with is the Turkish spoon salad, because when I was flipping through the book and I came upon that picture and those beautiful pomegranate, what we call seeds that aren't really seeds, but those beautiful little nuggets that look like gems, I thought, wow, this is kind of perfect for Thanksgiving.
A spoon salad in Turkey is a salad in which, and we call it a salad, it's not a leafy salad, it's a vegetable salad, but everything is chopped very, very finely, hand chopped with a knife, so that almost to the size of a puree, but not that small. So everything's chopped, 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 and then you actually eat it with a spoon, but aside from onions and tomatoes, there are, you know, sweet flavors like pomegranate and a little pomegranate vinegar, like pomegranate and pomegranate molasses, for instance, and chopped walnuts, chopped pistachios. It's really sort of very tasty little relish that you can either eat by the spoonful or spoon it onto your plate.
I think it's the perfect sort of addition to having that ubiquitous bowl of cranberry sauce for people who aren't really into cranberries.
Yeah, it's very fresh tasting.
And it would be beautiful with nice dark meat turkey.
Mm.
Okay, so potatoes.
So potatoes.
You have a love affair with potatoes. It's pretty clear.
Well, how could you not love a potato? There's a different chapter for each vegetable in the book, and some chapters are leaner than others. Potato happens to be a particularly large chapter. Potatoes are good for you as well, as you know, crave-worthy, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. So much potassium. More than a banana.
Indeed, that's right. And bananas are pretty good.
Yeah, bananas are pretty good. So what I loved was I loved your riffs on mashed potatoes. You give us choices, options.
Well, you know, there's your basic delicious mashed potatoes, however you like them. I usually use a little creme fraiche and a little butter.
A little butter?
Well, as much butter as seems correct. But adding a big handful of scallions, for instance, is a wonderful thing to do. Or stirring in some sharp cheddar toward the end. And then there are all the little variations, cooking a little bit of celery root in with the potatoes to give it that sort of celery root perfume, or some other root vegetables like parsnips.
Or turnips even.
Turnip and potato mash is awful good.
Really, really good. Do you have a particular variety of potato that you remember from California, since now you're a New Yorker? Particular variety that you still look for at the market?
Well, if I was making fried potatoes that I wanted to be crisp, I would look for a variety of russet called Castle Rock. Whether that still exists or not, I don't know. But for the most part, I like to use sort of a medium-sized yellow-fleshed potato, like a German Butterball or Yukon Gold kind of thing. I think they have a wonderful all-purpose use, and they have a beautiful color and flavor. Well, and then, of course, there are all kinds of little potatoes to roast, you know, like little fingerling potatoes, Russian bananas, and that sort of thing. There are a lot of farmers now are even growing rat, the R-A-T-T-E, rat potatoes from France.
Yeah, we have a couple really excellent farmers that bring us those. So you mentioned parsnips just a bit ago, and I noticed that you had a recipe that sort of puts them center of the dish and by themselves, which is unusual. We tend to think of parsnips as something to add to, like a broth or another sort of root mash. You actually have a dish where you pan roast the parsnips.
Roasted parsnips are good almost in any fashion at all, just chopped up and dressed, you know, with olive oil and salt, and in the oven, you're going to get something awfully delicious. But I pan roast them by pre-boiling them just until they're just barely done. And then they can be finished in the pan with butter or oil till they brown and crisp. Like, you know, like English roast potatoes always have that wonderful crisp edge on them, and that's what I'm going for here. But, of course, I can't resist maybe adding a little coriander or a little hot pepper at the end.
Remind us of what parsnips taste like, because I'm not so sure that everybody's actually eaten a parsnip by itself.
Oh, parsnips taste so good. Ethereal comes to mind, but the flavor to me is sort of a cross between a squash and a chestnut, but more heavenly.
That's so interesting because I think of them also as celery for like a more floral kind of celery.
They're definitely perfumey in a good way.
In a really good way.
Yeah.
And I actually think that this pan roast that you do would be great with the persillade or the gremolata that you have at the beginning of the book.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. It's definitely a candidate for some fresh chopped parsley and another tiny little head of garlic and maybe a little lemon zest. That would be great.
Yeah, it'd be so good.
Because that's actually a good thing for the everything on the Thanksgiving table.
That's true.
Give everything a little shower.
Yeah, since also the colors tend to be muddied and the flavors can be very repetitive.
Mm.
But the great thing about this recipe that I like, too, is that you can boil them in advance.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could actually throw them on a sheet pan and roast
them.
Yeah,
for sure, yeah. But, I mean, it's kind of based on what I've seen English cooks do when they make roast potatoes is they parboil the potatoes a little bit before they throw them around the roast. And that really gives them a kind of a wonderful floury texture on the inside and that wonderful crispness.
Crisp. So for something that isn't so crisp, but people seem to be just still besotted with cauliflower, which is a really good thing.
Yeah, cauliflower is definitely trending.
It's trending.
It's kind of wonderful to think of it as, you know, it'll never be elegant, but it's hot now.
Yeah, it's super hot. And you can buy these bags at Trader Joe's of, quote, cauliflower rice. And so I noticed that you have this recipe, cauliflower couscous.
Cauliflower couscous came to me in a dream, but of course there's nothing new under the sun. And then I began to read about a lot of Indian dishes where you grate the cauliflower on the large holes of a box grater to essentially get something like cauliflower rice. But as I was paring down a large cauliflower and making it into tiny florets, I one day thought, let's just go as small as we can, and ended up with a big bowl full of teeny, teeny, tiny florets that didn't really look like couscous, but sort of reminded me of couscous. And so then I hit them with some spicy butter and ended up serving them alongside, say, I don't know, well, a lot of things.
So do you sauté them with butter, or do you roast them, or did you steam them like you would steam couscous?
Well, no, but that would be a good idea. For ease of cooking, I simply blanch them in salted water first.
After you parboil them, what do you stew them with?
Well, you make a flavored butter. In this case, I'm using, well, turmeric for yellow, and then, of course, a speck of cayenne, and now some sweet spices like nutmeg and clove and dried ginger, fresh ginger, that sort of thing. But you're just making a butter that you like the taste of. This butter goes a little bit North African, but a little bit Indian, and it's a very forgiving recipe. And then you toss it with the cauliflower and let the tiny little cauliflower buds absorb all this great flavor.
You know, it's amazing. Cauliflower absorbs flavor so beautifully. It's sort of stunning that all of us were eating it just sort of boiled for so many centuries.
It's true. And still it survives in the garden.
Well, it's gorgeous. I mean, you got to love those beautiful white heads.
When you taste them freshly picked, like there's definitely a difference between a cauliflower that you get at the farmer's market than the cauliflower that arrives wrapped in cello a week later from out west.
If it's a week. So I've noticed over the past maybe 2 years that a different kind of mushroom has been arriving in the market. I mean, I tend to shop often in Korean supermarkets, and they're always there in depth, which are these grilled royal trumpets.
Mm-hmm. They almost look like porcini, in that they have a big fat stem, and they're tall-ish. Their cap, as opposed to porcini, doesn't spread that wide, but they're firm. If you can't get a wild porcini, then this makes an awfully good substitute. It doesn't have the deepness of porcini, but it really has a wonderful flavor. And they're great for grilling.
Really great for grilling. Or sautéing, and they, because of the way they're grown, the entire thing is usable. There's like no trash at all.
For the most part, you can use the whole thing.
So when you grill or you sauté them, what kind of herb do you like to use? I know that you love herbs. What would be your fave for this?
I probably use a little rosemary, although I may not say that in the book. That's the way I'm feeling right now. But it's one of those things. They're so sweet and meaty that just a little olive oil and salt is enough, but you slip a little bit of garlic and a tiny bit of sprinkled rosemary just to give it a little extra je ne sais quoi. Makes them that much better, perhaps, but they can also go in a more Asian direction, you know. Everything likes a ginger-garlic marinade as well.
With Thanksgiving, particularly if one is inviting several people, having everything served hot, I think is just too hard to even try and attempt. It seems to me that a lot of these recipes would be absolutely fine served at room temperature.
Many, many, many of them are. I agree. It's too much of a hassle, but it's also a lot of stuff tastes really good at room temperature. So I would say keep the stuff that really needs to be hot, like mashed potatoes, in a piping hot. But if your cauliflower is at room temperature and it tastes and it's dressed with something delicious, it's going to be perfectly fine on the plate. And our whole mania for piping hot food anyway is not, it's an impossible dream is what it really is. Make the gravy hot.
Thank you so much, David.
Pleasure.
I've been talking to David Tanis, who was chef at Chez Panisse for many years. He writes a weekly food column for the New York Times, and his new cookbook is called Market Cooking. Find his recipes for mashed potatoes and cauliflower couscous on our Good Food blog. Visit blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. It's time to head to the Santa Monica Farmers Market for another great Thanksgiving idea. Here's Laura Avery with the Market Report.
I'm standing next to probably the most festive market cart I've seen at the market in months, maybe years. And of course, this belongs to cocktail chef Matt Biancanello. Matt is well known as being one of the founding father of the cocktail chef movement here in LA. He's a market shopper, a forager. He grows his own. He's usually bedecked with either his kids' teething toys or a flower lei of some sort. He's got his signature fedora. Anyway, that's Matt. And Matt is here today with a cart loaded with indescribable produce, which Matt, you will now describe for us. And tell us what cocktail you're working on now.
So the cocktail I'm working on for right now, which is obviously, thank you so much, by the way. That's an amazing introduction. This is the first, we're into the second week now of JJ's Lawn Daughters, Hachia Persimmons. And like you said, I don't know how she picks them so perfectly that they just appear this amazing plumpness. But
now let's talk about the Hachia as opposed to the Fuya. What is it about the Hachia?
Well, the Hachia for me, now you have to think about for cocktails. Most of what I do is so instantaneous and it's all about instant vibrancy. It's very different. Like, even though I consider myself thinking like a chef, I could never do what they do because it's like all of that preparation and all of the work that they do to prepare for that. A lot of what I do is right on the spot. The Fuyu, for me, sometimes can be very hard. They can be a little bit on the chalky side. Whereas you have this amazing Hachia right away. It's like you know you can make a cocktail instantaneous. And it has the pulp. It has everything that you would want in a fruit, basically.
That's the fully ripe Hachia, the soft one.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the thing is, I've made gazpacho with those in the past and put them on oysters. There's a lot of versatility to them. It's actually one of the few things, too, that works really well if you tend to blend it. You know, I'm not a huge fan of blending, but it does work really, really well, and also great as a frozen dessert.
Yeah, and in their fully ripe state, they literally are almost too soft to handle. So how do you possibly skin a ripe Hachia?
I don't have to skin it because I'll use the skin, which is great. And the thing is when you cut it in half and you see that kind of star, it's just the perfect, perfect symmetry of a creature to me.
Yes, when you cut it across the middle and look at both sides, and it's kind of like a sand dollar. Like it's got those, whatever those are.
Better description, yes.
Yeah. Magical.
Magical. So what I want to do is something very simple. I'm working on a bunch of what's been great is I've consulted for the cocktail menu at Isabel in West Hollywood. I'm also going to do Laurel Canyon as well. But one of the things I'm doing is I'm popping up there every Wednesday night. But one of the things that I'm doing that's just kind of instantaneous that I sit down is this is a cocktail just with everything that's kind of, for me, my type of autumn, which is a guava tequila, fresh passion fruit, and then the persimmons. And then I also got a pine cone. It's called a pignon. It's a special type of pine cone from the forest here. It's actually an amazing recipe that dates back to the 17th century where they would take these dry pine cones and put them in a jar just with sugar, and within 2 months it would liquefy into a syrup without adding anything. It's phenomenal, you know? So instead, what I did is I put this in the Saint-Germain and used that as a sweetener. So what you're going to taste is just this kind of blast of like autumn and freshness, and then you'll right in the end you should taste that pine cone. It's very, very simple. You don't have to add any sugar. I put a little bit of lime juice. So do you want to try a small sip?
Yes, I
do. So there you go. This is a guava tequila, a little bit of persimmons, and you should taste that pine cone Saint-Germain right at the end. It should just be creamy, refreshing, and then the pine.
I do taste the pine. The passion fruit is overwhelming. No. Fabulous. It's passion fruit, so it's there.
Yeah, this is more like, amazing. For me, it's like an amuse-bouche. So I want people to sit down. It's a vibrancy. It's not meant to be a full cocktail. It's meant to be a nice sipper to really capture the fall, capture Thanksgiving. But it's really about that little pine at the end and then that zap. passion fruit and persimmon is one of my favorite combinations.
And this is the time of year for both.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Always great to be here. And I always love seeing you every week.
Good to see you too, Matt, when you're not out on the hillside foraging. Thank you so much. That was Matt Biancanello. He's doing a pop-up every Wednesday night at Isabel, which is on Fairfax, just north of Melrose. He will be there every Wednesday night from 6 till midnight, all the way through Christmas. Go belly up to the bar and talk to Matt, and he will dazzle you with some amazing cocktail. We're talking now with Laura Ramirez, who is known at the market as JJ's Lone Daughter Ranch. And Laura, you're back. You took a month and a half off between your avocado and your persimmon season. You grow beautiful persimmons. You hand pack those ripe hachillas. So tell us what it is about how you do such a good job of bringing your persimmons ready for the market.
Well, we make sure they're ripe and ready to eat. You know, a lot of times if you don't have ripe hachillas, it'll take weeks for them to ripen up. And I don't want anybody coming back with a puckery mouth saying, oh my goodness, why did you sell me that? So I have the ripe hachillas. I have fuyus. We have different kinds of chocolatey, marui, cinnamony persimmons. And I just love them all. But I really love the hachillas because they're just so sweet and yummy. And they taste kind of custardy. And they have such great texture and flavor. And you can dollop some whipped cream on it or pour a little rum on top. And it's even better.
It's just like dessert, fruit dessert.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. It's like one of the best. And it's even great frozen. So it's just all around the greatest fruit.
So you let them, so you make sure they get fully ripe on the tree. You don't just pick a hard hachilla and then put it on the counter and expect it to ripen?
Well, you know, what we do is we pick it and then we let it ripen, but we take the time to let it ripen. My workers would be really upset with me if they plucked it straight from the tree. It'd probably rain down persimmon goo on them. So I just make sure that they're not hard. You know, a lot of people bring them hard and, oh boy, we don't want to do that, like I said.
But it's hard to bring them soft. They're literally like little bowls of pudding in a skin. How do you keep them from just not exploding on the way to the market?
Tender, loving care.
Good suspension on your truck.
Exactly.
So I think a lot of people, if they're lucky enough to see a persimmon tree, they'll see all persimmons and no leaves. Is there a certain time of the year when the leaves fall and then you know they're ready?
Well, right now, you know, you never want to have any green shoulders on your persimmons because they're going to be a little bit too tart. You want to make sure they're all orange before you pick it. They're really beautiful. They look like ornaments on a tree, like these globes of orange. So they're really beautiful right now.
Let's talk a little bit about the fuyu and describe what that looks like and then how that one is consumed.
Well, the fuyu looks exactly like a tomato. Everybody kind of gets them confused. It's kind of orange and a little bit flat. What I always recommend is when you pick it off of the farmer's market table, make sure that you do not put it in the refrigerator. If you refrigerate them, they'll get soft. A lot of people do that and then they say, oh my gosh, they got soft. And then they put them in the refrigerator, so no refrigeration on those fuyus.
And the skin's a little bit thicker on the fuyu than the hachilla.
It is. That you can definitely eat the skin on the hachilla. It's kind of like a big water balloon. So when you kind of bite into it, you know, you got to watch yourself or you drip all over yourself.
Right, which is the whole fun.
Exactly.
It makes them fun, yeah. Yeah, we're excited now. It is persimmon season and we're starting to see them everywhere. And yours come in dark orange, which is nice because we see a lot of kind of yellow persimmons. But yours, you kind of wait till they're really orange.
Yeah, I want to make sure they're ripe, but I don't want any complaints. I don't want any pucker mouths. Oh my gosh, why did you sell me that?
Okay, well, I think you got a lot of happy customers, including Matt.
Yeah, I like Matt. You know, Matt's always been a great customer, and he creates some delicious drinks and cocktails, and we appreciate him.
We appreciate you. Thank you,
Thank
Laura.
Thank you.
That was Laura Ramirez. She's known as JJ's Lone Daughter. Her ranch is located in San Bernardino County. And persimmons are fantastic on your Thanksgiving table. You can use them, as Laura said, for a dessert. You can slice them. You can make one of Matt's cocktails. And they make beautiful table decorations. So please enjoy. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
After the break, we take a brief pause from Thanksgiving to learn about a truly amazing discovery in an antique book fair. Stay with us. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman.
We had not heard of her. We were kind of shocked that we hadn't once we learned who she was, because she really was a very influential figure in both publishing and design and illustration. I mean, sort of across the span of industries where Wendy and I work, she was significant, and yet neither of us had heard her name.
That's writer Sarah Rich. While browsing an antiquarian book fair, she and illustrator Wendy McNaughton stumbled upon an old sketchbook. Flipping through its pages, they saw vivid paintings, perfect hand lettering, and recipes celebrating Jewish food and culture. It turned out to be a circa 1945 unpublished manuscript by a woman named C.P. Pinellas. Pinellas was the first female art director at Condé Nast. Sarah and Wendy helped bring her sketchbook to life in a new book called Leave Me Alone with the Recipes, The Life, Art, and Cookbook of C.P. Pinellas.
Well, Sarah had called and asked if I would like to join her at the Antiquarian Book Fair, and I got there a little bit earlier than she did, and I was walking along and spotted inside a glass case a book that was open to a beautiful painting of a bowl of borscht, which doesn't sound like maybe the most appealing thing, but the colors were so vibrant. It was a fuchsia in a scalloped mint bowl, and the hand lettering for the recipe was just precise and beautiful and looked like it done with a quill. So I asked the gentleman if he would show it to me. He took it out and put it on the counter in front of me. And that's when it was very clear that it was the original. It was done in gouache, which is this, when it's done as perfectly as C.P. does it, it's this beautiful kind of chalky, silky texture, and that all of the lettering was done, you know, with ink, and it was absolutely mind-blowing, like nothing that I had really ever seen before. And though the work looked very familiar to me, in some ways it looked like my own work and other illustrators, like maybe Myra Kallman's work, it was something that I had never seen before.
So what also intrigues me is that your initial impulse was to put together a team that could kind of decide what to do with this object that you purchased.
Sarah and I came at this, as you said, from our two different overlapping perspectives and loved it. And we're so taken with it and so intrigued by C.P. Pinellas, just with a quick bit of Googling that we did on the spot and learned how influential she has been, was in her time, and that we hadn't heard of her, we jumped on the phone and called our friends Maria Popova and Debbie Millman. We shared this with them because Debbie is a designer and an artist herself and works in design and branding, and Maria Popova is the woman behind Brain Pickings, which is a website about art, culture, history, science, and a lot of biographies. And we shared it with them, and they were taken with it just as we were. So the four of us decided to go in on it together, and we purchased the book on the spot.
Tell us who CP was. Where did she come from?
She came from Vienna, Austria. She was born in 1908, and she moved with her family to Poland, and then they came to the U.S., to New York, in 1915. And she was always interested in art. She was always an artist. And, you know, there are stories of her high school yearbook saying that she, you know, she was going to marry her art. So she went to Pratt for her own schooling in art and then started working at Condé Nast. So she was hired as the first female art director at Condé Nast in the late 30s.
I mean, in the late 30s, how big a deal was that?
I think it was a big deal. She came in as the apprentice to the sort of eminent art director at the time, whose name was M.F. Aga. And she was apprenticing with him, but it didn't take long before she was appointed to be the art director of Glamour. But from her sort of outlook about women in culture, she actually didn't really love the way Glamour treated its readers. It didn't treat women like they had a future in long, illustrious, substantive careers, or that they were particularly intellectual. And so she really still was longing to do something that would treat women the way she felt they ought to be treated. And so that came along soon after, when she became the art director for 17 when it launched. She was a part of the trio of women who launched 17 magazine, and that in itself kind of launched a whole new market of young women who were really being addressed as whole people.
You know, looking through the book, looking at her illustrations, it's so modern. I mean, it's so contemporary. Could you talk a little bit about the impact that her particular design style had on the culture?
At the time, there were no computers. There was no layouts that people were doing, you know, on the computer before they went to do a photo shoot, or no sketches that were being done digitally. Everything was done by hand. Everything was painted out. Comps were created by hand. And so when we're looking at the recipes in this book, you're seeing C.P. Pinellas. She was, as Sarah said, she was trained as an artist, but she refined her skills doing her layout. When she was at the magazine, she would do beautiful little comps that would turn into refined sketches. Her typography, she laid out by hand. When she was choosing her type, she would sketch that out. So what we're seeing in this book is the result of many years of practice, both in her schooling and also in her work. So that's her hand. But her role as an art director was hugely influential in the way that we work and look at illustration today. She was the first art director to, if not hire fine artists as illustrators, to work with illustrators as full collaborators. So instead of assigning a piece to an illustrator and telling them what to draw, say if it was a piece about a chicken, telling the illustrator to draw a chicken, she would, you know, hand the piece to an artist and say, here, you know, read this, and why don't you come back to me with some ideas, and let's talk about it, and then do artwork based on that. And so she collaborated with artists like Ben Shawn and Andy Warhol. She was one of the first people to hire Andy Warhol as an illustrator.
So let's talk about the food. Let's talk about the recipes. Which ones immediately stood out to you?
Well, the borscht was the first one we saw, and that stood out, you know, because the pinks are just so brilliant. But in addition, I mean, she drew all the ingredients for all of these, but she also drew all the cookware and all of the utensils. And to, I think, both of us, that was equally stunning. I mean, the chicken soup illustration has the, you know, old blue and white enamelware that you see, that sort of classic enamel. And she's incredible at capturing, you know, the stainless steel of a pot or the copper in a bundt pan. And, you know, I was really struck by just the capacity to convey material, as well as the texture, of course, of all the vegetables. And even, you know, there's an illustration of like a raw chicken leg, and you really get the rawness of that chicken leg. Throughout the book, she features her mother. So these are her mother's recipes. And actually, on the original cover of her sketchbook, the title she gave it was Leave Me Alone with the Recipes. And the author on that book, as she put it, is Mrs. Pinellas, her mother. And then it says illustrated by C.P. Pinellas. So these are really her mother's recipes. And a gray-haired, bespectacled lady appears in a bunch of the paintings, and that's her mom.
How did you deal with the recipes when you first started testing them? Did they work the way they were written?
The short answer is no. This is Sarah. I set out to make all of them exactly as written initially, just to sort of see what they were like. And many of them did not really hold up if you followed them exactly as she wrote them. The first one that I tried was kalacha, which is meatloaf. So I was expecting, you know, a sliceable meatloaf, but it ended up being more of a sauce. You know, she has you grate tomatoes on a grater. And of course, there were no food processors or other kind of electrical tools to help out in the kitchen. So some of them work differently, probably because our ingredients may be different now. The way we cook may be different now. The quality of different things. So I did. I cooked through everything and then went back through to kind of update them, both so that they would work as a set of instructions that someone could follow, and so they would be a little bit more aligned with modern tastes, and so that they would contain ingredients that people can find now in grocery stores, because there were some things that were either a mystery to me or just things that are really difficult to find in an average grocery, like parsley root.
Could you briefly describe what it was like to visit her home?
Wow. Yeah.
Well, the home we visited, so we didn't actually visit the home where she had lived. Toward the end of her life, she lived in a house in Stony Point, New York, which is about 40 minutes north of New York City. But we went to visit her daughter's home, which is in Toronto. And I'm sure Wendy will want to add to this, because so much of this, I think, for someone who's an artist, it was just really striking. And I wish we could have had a camera crew upon entering the door of this house, because it was really just wall to wall, floor to ceiling, an expression of that time and of CP herself and of her work, and also of the work of her whole cohort, because she was a part of a really tight group of designers and artists working in New York in the mid-century. And so there were works, original works on the walls from so many much better known than CP was.
Well, thank you so much for allowing us to peek into that world. It's a stupendous book and would make just the most perfect gift for the holiday season.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thanks, Evan.
Thank you.
That's author Sarah Rich and illustrator Wendy McNaughton. Their new book is called Leave Me Alone with the Recipes, The Life, Art, and Cookbook of C.P. Pinellas. Now, a recommendation for eating out from Jonathan Gold. Where are we headed this week?
Yeah, we're going to Inkwell in West Hollywood, which is basically a chopped and channeled version. Not even a version of it. It is the restaurant Ink, Michael Voltaggio's place, moved a few blocks up and sort of repurposed. as a regular restaurant.
Which is really interesting, given his background as really one of the first younger chefs who was presenting modernist cuisine.
And he still does. My favorite dessert there is it's a sort of like Mexican chocolate ganache painted over cookie crumbs and topped with like this rubble of, I guess, liquid nitrogen frozen horchata.
Which just sounds so much fun to me.
It's so fun. The one weird thing is like when I put too much of it at the same time, I didn't realize how much gas was in there, and it just like sort of all exploded at once, and I barked involuntarily like a little Pekingese.
And it must have been very entertaining for those you were dining with in terms of the amount of steam coming out of your mouth.
Oh, yeah. You can even see steam coming out of your ears.
Okay, so how has he managed to do it, to take something that is very fine dining, high-end, and sort of repurpose it? Because I think more eaters probably don't want to sit through a lot of that, or they think they don't want to anyway.
The dining room is still, like, dark, but it's lighter, and it's more open, and it's more sort of, it feels like a regular restaurant than some sort of secret den that you managed to go into. I mean, I've heard friends reference the trophy room in a Beverly Hills mansion, and it's not completely wrong. You can go there, and you can get a burger, which never would have had. And it's not even a strange burger. I mean, it comes with beef belly, bacon, a whipped cheese that I'm sure exists through some modernist process. One of my waitresses actually sort of was dreaming that she could pipe it into a wading pool. You can go there and you can have an old-fashioned steak and a salad, except, you know, they'll probably be an Amaro infusion with the old-fashioned, and the frisée will be garnished with pig's ear, and the steak is going to come with seaweed mashed potatoes, but it's like sort of a regular meal. But it's definitely still the Vitaggio restaurant. I mean, one of his signatures in the last year was his tomato, which is sort of a all-in-one insalata caprese. It's a ball of fresh mozzarella's that's been smoked and has been glazed in sort of this painstaking process to look exactly like a tomato. So you think you're cutting into tomato, but in fact you're cutting into cheese that's been coated with tomato.
In the review, you say that it's as if someone who had never ever seen a caprese salad before invented a caprese salad.
That's how you would imagine a Martian might translate it. If you've been to Inc., you've had his tiny boiled potatoes crusted with salt, like the ones that they've always served at Bazaar when he was the executive chef there, tinted black with charcoal, or egg yolks that are gelled into gnocchi that are sort of gooey in the center, or dyeing octopus black with its own ink when you fry it, which is an interesting trick.
And overall, did you find the experience more pleasurable than when it was a bit more obfuscatory?
It's hard to say. I mean, part of the magic of Inc., I think, was the sort of presence of Vitaggio and his crew, many of who have been with him since his very earliest days at Bazaar, sort of conjuring things in the back. Here, it's things you can order from a menu, and they come from a kitchen, and they're put in front of you.
More pedestrian?
It's not more pedestrian, but it's almost a different experience, right? So you order, like, the shrimp, and it comes out, and you can't even see the shrimp because they're covered with this, you know, blizzard of fresh dill. He likes blizzards, and he likes putting things under things. The marinated shrimp are lovely. They come with shrimp chips that are seasoned with Old Bay. The taste is like something you might get in a paper cone in Baltimore Harborside or something.
Is it the same price?
It's pretty much the same price, I think. It's still has the illusions of being a small plates place. You order a few things for the table, and there's often things that you weren't expecting that would show up. Like there's a salad of, you know, endive spears, which sounds ordinary from the menu, but you get it, and it's this micro microscopically thin slices of pickle pear laid out over the endive and topped with, you know, handfuls of frozen crumbled feta.
That sounds incredible.
And it looks like vegetables, but it sort of slices and tastes like pizza.
How bizarre.
It's lovely. I like people who are, like, trying to trick you, to make you think that you're encountering things that you're not. That you order beets, and when you order beets, you should expect something, you know, bright, you know, purpley red staring at you instead of coming out with this bleak Antarctic snowscape of grayish and white. But when you start cutting under through the horseradish snow and you come across the beets, it's a delightful sensation. Not everybody likes Voltaggio's cooking, and I can see why. Sometimes there's nori in places where you don't want nori, and sometimes when he's doing things that you've had everywhere else, like he does a version of street corn that's okay, you start to wonder what the big deal is. But he is one of the chefs in town who still has that sense of theater about what he's doing. Inkwell is very good now, and I have no doubt that he's going to figure out a way to sort of adapt to his new venue, to adapt his food to a new kind of theater.
Well, thank you so much, Jonathan.
So glad to be here, Evan.
That's Jonathan Gold's review of Inkwell in West Hollywood. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. Text the words good food to 69866 and you'll get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. Coming up, we revisit the Thanksgiving table and we're talking about, you guessed it, pie and dessert. Don't go anywhere. I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Whether you're assembling the entire Thanksgiving meal or charged with just bringing the pie, dessert's an essential part of the celebration, and who's better on that subject than Noelle Carter of the LA Times? Side note, she's also a judge of the Good Food Pie Contest.
That's my favorite job.
I personally am very happy I don't have to do that job. But it does give you an incredible bird's eye view of quality.
You know, there are things that I learned from other judges that I never would have thought of baking my own pies, and I try to be pretty critical. But there are just so many things that you learn and so many tips and tricks that you learn, and there are so many great pies that are entered every year. So creative.
That's true. Okay, so let's talk about this particular challenge, which for most people is kind of scary, pulling off this successful Thanksgiving. But I think that the kind of person you are, which is hyper-organized, is what one needs as a guide to really pull off this holiday.
It helps to be organized. But as many times as you do it, there are still things at the last minute that I forget. And you try to roll with it and keep a smile.
Always a smile. It is, after all, only
food. And a creative Thanksgiving hat.
Yes. How far in advance can we bake a pie and still have it delicious on the day of?
You know, I've baked pies sometimes 2 to 3 days in advance. I mean, it really depends on the type of pie. So many pies you can freeze before baking, and then when you can squeeze in some baking time, you know, bake it in between the turkey and some of the sides. It's just all in the matter of planning. But you can bake a custard pie or a fruit pie, you know, a couple days, up to 3 days in advance.
Yeah, I really love to freeze my fruit pies and then bake them at night and just leave them out.
There you go. Yeah.
And pecan pies do well a couple days before. They're like a confection anyway.
And sometimes, depending on how they're flavored and spiced, you add a touch of bourbon and some really nice spices. They only improve with a little bit of time.
It's true. You don't have to attempt everything the day of. That's guaranteed to make you insane.
Even for professionals, you're never going to get it done.
So it all starts with the crust. What is your easiest go-to crust recipe?
You know, my mom, who's an incredible pie baker, used Crisco growing up, and she still uses Crisco. And I have to say, there's something about shortening that really makes for a light and flaky crust. So I used part Crisco and I use part butter, because you really get the flavor with butter and you get better coloring with butter. So it's butter heavy when it comes to the fat, but I always add a little shortening in there just for insurance.
And for people who don't want to go the Crisco route, they can always use Earth Balance baking sticks.
There you go. Or lard.
Yeah, I'm a big advocate of the lard.
Lard is magical.
Yeah, it is magical. For people who are newbies, I always tell them, make a pie crust with half lard and half butter.
There you go.
Because it's just almost impossible to fail.
It is.
And it'll taste good, even if it's a little tough.
It's still great.
Okay, so pumpkin, pecan, apple, they're all ubiquitous this time of year, and they all have their adherents. But are there any other favorites that you have that you like to move into the mix?
You know, I know sweet potato and pumpkin are sometimes interchangeable, but I really, really love a good sweet potato pie. And several years ago, I ran across a George Washington Carver sliced sweet potato pie. It's a two-layer pie. It's got the crust on top, and it's really magical. And it's simple, and you have these sliced sweet potatoes. They cook inside the crust, and they're thinly sliced. And we have the recipe is on our LA Times database. And it's just a great pie, and it's just a little tweak on the tradition. So you've got something new and different, but still familiar enough that people will try it.
It's interesting because usually when you see a sweet potato pie, it's open lid.
Yeah, no, this, it has the crust on top, but it's really homey looking, very, very comforting, but really delicious.
And if we want to do pumpkin pie, is it forbidden to use canned pumpkin?
I found you get the most consistent results with canned pumpkin. I mean, if you know the farmer that's making the pumpkins or that's growing the pumpkins, you can sometimes find great pumpkins at your farmer's market. But inevitably, every single year, I always use the canned pumpkin just because I know it's consistent, I know the flavor is going to be great, and I know what the results are going to be. You can't always guarantee that when you're baking your own pumpkins.
Yeah, I think you have to, because of the moisture in a fresh pumpkin, you're going to have to be more comfortable with tweaking that custard.
And you never know the sugar content, too, because as the pumpkins sit, they increase in their sugar. But you really don't know until you've cracked it open and baked it before you put it in the filling how it's going to turn out.
And when you look at the ingredients on canned pumpkin, it's just pumpkin.
Right.
So, you know, it may not be local, but it is pretty simple.
And when you want to save time, you know, it's already pureed, it's ready to go.
It's hard for me to imagine that anybody doesn't love pie, but I do know that those kinds of people exist, and I shouldn't think any less of them. So what else do you have on the table for those outliers?
You know, it seems like every year I'm always getting emails from readers about pumpkin cheesecake or, you know, something. They still want pumpkin somewhere. We get requests for pumpkin cake recipes, pumpkin tart recipes, pumpkin custard or pudding recipes. And then, you know, if you're just tired of pumpkin and you're just not a pumpkin fan, go with apple or, you know, there's so much great fruit in season right now. Apples, pears, you know, whatnot, cranberries. Riff on those and make your own cakes or tarts or ice cream.
Oh, yeah, ice cream.
We're in California. And it looks like it's going to be warmer next week for Thanksgiving. So,
yeah, I actually am writing for you all for the LA Times an article on eating autumnal ice cream.
Yes, and we tested it, and it's a wonderful recipe.
Yeah, a recipe from Roxana Julepot, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, from Friends and Family. I wish I had been there the day that you were tasting.
We still have some in the freezer. Stop by the test kitchen.
So if we're a person who just wants to enjoy and we're not going to get our hands dirty baking this year, where can we go to find some good desserts? I have to say that this used to be pretty much a pie wasteland, but mm-hmm. that is not true anymore.
No, not at all. There are so many great chefs and restaurants and bakeries right now that are offering pies for Thanksgiving. Jen Harris, our deputy food editor, just did a post last week listing well over a dozen chefs that are baking their own pies. Roxana at Friends and Family, she's got a host of pies that she's going to be making. You just order them ahead of time and pick them up. David Lefebvre, Manhattan Beach Post, is doing it. Zoe Nathan, Huckleberry, Little Dom's. If you want kind of a southern twist on pies, they're offering brown butter, pumpkin, coconut cream, and a cane syrup pecan pie, which sounds really good.
Wow, that sounds really good.
And then getting back to that ice cream theme, there are at least three places that are going to be offering ice cream pies. Sweet Rose Creamery, McConnell's is offering, of course, ice cream pies, and Small Batch in Mar Vista is going to be offering a couple of ice cream pies.
Thank you so much, Noelle. I'm hungry now, and I'm already feeling guilty that I haven't already done my pie prep shopping.
I'm already making my grocery list of all the stuff. I think I'm going to be spending the entire weekend at the store shopping for stuff and figuring out how to plan my Thanksgiving so I don't forget anything this year.
Yes, I don't think we'll be alone this weekend shopping.
No, I have a funny feeling the grocery stores are going to be quite packed.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Noelle Carter's the Test Kitchen Director for the LA Times. This Thanksgiving, she's got dessert covered. Coming up, we close out our show with our old friend, Sang Yoon, who's here with the radical message of what he calls Sangsgiving. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman.
But if you're literally buying like this frozen orb at the market and, you know, calling me at 6 a.m. and asking me how many hours per pound I have to put this in.
That's Chef Sang Yoon. This Thanksgiving, many will try to recreate the Norman Rockwell image of a beautifully basted turkey with all the trimmings. Sang is not one of them. Instead, he has some strong opinions about how to create Thanksgiving memories that are both unconventional and decadent.
Who's Norman Rockwell?
An old white guy?
Yeah.
Who passed quite a bit of time ago.
You know, I was reading about the very first Thanksgiving, the 1600s. The whole thing sounded shady to me. He said they served wild turkey, but, you know, one could interpret that as perhaps the cheap whiskey. You just don't know. And apparently, because it was in Plymouth, Mass., there was apparently a lot of seafood served. Maybe some eel, some oysters, who knows, a lobster roll. I think the traditional, in air quotes, Thanksgiving is probably a loose translation of tradition at best.
Okay, but let's address the issue of turkey. And you, for example, do you like turkey?
I don't. And my cell phone number on Thanksgiving morning turns into literally the Butterball hotline.
Mine too.
Yeah, it's, yeah, yeah.
Everybody, people you haven't talked to in months, perhaps years, call you.
Yeah, it's strangers. Literally strangers call me. What do I do?
And what do you tell them?
Well, I get calls like at 6 a.m. saying, I'm about to put the bird in, you know.
But you have made turkeys over the years.
I have. And like most people, they turn out poorly. And I've tried, you know, every chefy possible technique from air drying it like a Chinese Peking duck all the way to stuffing the skin with white truffles.
Those are expensive fails.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, it just kind of tastes like benign protein. And I think, you know, for all the trouble that people go through, it's just, I don't see what the payoff is with turkey.
So having put that sort of giant ball of protein in the mental trash bin for yourself, I understand that you have come up with something that you call Sangsgiving. Perhaps you would give us an outline of what this is.
It's just my version. It's just the, you know, my subversive version of this holiday that we all take off. And, you know, one of the very few days in the restaurant business you can take off. And, of course, those of us who cook for a living, great. It's a day we cook. Awesome. You know?
Yeah. How I used to solve that problem was I just didn't take the day off. We served Thanksgiving at Angeli for years because I just didn't want to deal with the family issues around it. So it was just easier.
Well, my new tradition is now just going to Lowry's. I mean, I love prime rib, but, you know, I don't want to make it. And Lowry's is close and it's awesome and it's open and it's packed.
And it's so fun. And you can have a C.C. Brown's Hot Fudge Sundae for dessert.
Yeah, it's better.
But when you were doing it on your own, give us an idea of how you would start. First of all, I know that you are a huge champagne aficionado, and you have a pretty deep collection.
Yeah, champagne, you know, if I'm having a gathering for cooking away from the restaurant, and there's always a few bottles of champagne open. I think it pairs beautifully. Any sommelier will agree with me in terms of its broad spectrum. You know, champagne pairs with so many things. It's easy to pair. And the flavors of fall, rosé champagne, it's brilliant, whether it's duck, even if it's turkey. If you're invited to someone's Thanksgiving dinner, a great bottle to bring is a rosé champagne. It will be delicious.
Do you ever sully champagne by using it in cocktails?
I try not to, because champagne's so good by itself. Yeah, I don't add anything to champagne.
Is rosé champagne necessarily pricey to get a decent bottle?
Not necessarily. There's a lot on the market. The rosé champagnes, the assemblage, where they take a little bit of the red wine and add it to the white wine, tend to be less expensive. The ones, the Saignée, the one they bleed off, they tend to be a little more expensive. But no, there's good values in champagne, the rosés, you know, well under $100.
Given that Thanksgiving or Sangsgiving happens during this time of year, what are the things that you love to see on the table and that you also like to cook on this day when everyone else is having off and yet you are cooking?
you know, the only thing I advocate for is eat what you like. It's a lot of work. Just find something you genuinely like eating for yourself and sharing. I think this year, if it happens, Thanksgiving incidentally doesn't happen every year. It's sort of like a leap year Olympics kind of thing. It may or may not happen and generally happens with very short notice. But I might do sweetbreads this year. You know, whether it's a rack of lamb, a prime rib, something big, something that's impressive for the center of the table is always nice. But no, I don't have a set protein. I may try a vegetarian Thanksgiving. Sorry, Thanksgiving.
I think that sweetbreads is sort of interesting because I think of the turkey as something that pretty much everyone either loves or just tolerates.
Tolerates is, I think, the best.
I actually really like turkey, but I confit mine. I confit the legs and the thighs.
Yeah, that's great.
And then I roast them off, and it's like turkey carnitas. I prefer that to chicken. I like turkey.
Why not just carnitas? Why not just like a nice heritage pig?
Because you're going to hate me for this. Pork is not like my favorite meat.
Okay.
Perhaps it's in my DNA.
Okay.
I don't know.
All right.
I'm sorry, all those chefs who have sent me free plates of pork belly.
Mm. A pork belly would be great. How about a brisket? Maybe like treat it like a Seder.
No.
No? Okay.
It's not. Brisket is great. I love brisket. But I'm intrigued by the idea of the sweetbreads choice because having recently come back from Rome, I actually ate sweetbreads many times and remembered how unbelievably delicious it is and how hard it is to get other people to eat it.
Yeah, it is such a delicious part of the animal, and it's sad because we can't, like from the restaurant perspective, we can't give it away. I'm always amazed that people are confused. They think it's actually just bread. They think it's like King's Hawaiian bread.
Yes.
But yeah, no, I think it's like a forgotten organ.
What is sweetbread? Remind us.
It's a thymus gland. It's an interesting organ.
And describe the texture.
It doesn't have a profound flavor. Well, if you fry it, which a lot of people do, imagine the most fluffy, perfect chicken nugget.
I was going to say chicken tender.
Yeah. It's very mild in flavor. It's completely inoffensive to anybody. If you didn't know what it was, I don't know anyone who wouldn't eat it as long as you ate meat, but it is absolutely delicious. And I think more people should try and explore this particular organ that we often forget. In fact, at Lakshan, we do something called sweetbreads orange chicken style, where we simply replicate Panda Express orange chicken and replace chicken with sweetbreads. And it's amazing. And people have no idea that it's something other than chicken. It's like the most succulent, juicy, delicious orange chicken you've ever had because it's not chicken. I might do like roasted lobes of sweetbread this year.
Okay, so now that we have sweetbreads as the main event on our Thanksgiving table, what would some of the sides be?
Again, anything you like.
So you don't try because it's seasonal. You don't think of squash or sweet potatoes or... This look on your face is totally befuddled.
Again, I don't try to follow a path of what I'm supposed to cook on that day. I kind of think of Thanksgiving the way Jews think of Christmas, and I just, you know, maybe try something Chinese. I may, again, if I'm cooking, I may do sort of like a green beans and XO sauce, just whatever kind of floats my boat that day. But I don't think of, you know, something like green beans with almonds or I don't.
Bechamel.
Yeah. You know, I don't
crisped
do that.
Crisped onions.
Or I don't do that disgusting thing people do with the yams and the marshmallows. I have no idea what that is.
Well, I don't
it's
know
so
what
disgusting.
That is. I think that's a whole cultural context situation.
Yeah, but, you know, people bring that over all the time, you know, and I have to, like, tell them not to do it. Like, whatever that.
Oh, they bring it to Thanksgiving?
They try.
You allow potluck?
Yeah, I do allow people to bring food over if they want to. Because sometimes chefs come over and they say, can I bring something? And I go, yeah, anything except that, whatever that sweet potato marshmallow thing is. I don't know what that is, but keep that out of my house.
And then what about desserts?
I'm not the biggest fan of pumpkin or pumpkin pie. You know, just cheese, maybe a demi-sec champagne, whiskey, bourbon. Maybe that, where's it? This is where the wild turkey comes in, maybe. But yeah, pumpkin pie, whipped cream, no. Oh, that's the other thing about Thanksgiving I hate, is that damn cranberry sauce. What the hell is that? It doesn't even go with turkey, if you think about it, culinarily.
Well, no, it does a bit. If you substitute it in your mind for red currants or lingonberries, then you can imagine the patrimony of cranberries. They are American, presumably.
Okay.
Personally, I've switched my cranberry situation to a Dory Greenspan recipe of baked pineapple with tons of spices.
Mm. I could see sort of a fruit chutney working with turkey, but I would never think of cranberry as a logical pairing to such a benign, flavorless bird. It's so epically bright and...
I think it probably came about before the birds were so benign tasting.
Maybe when they were really gamey and wild, and actually wild. Okay, all right, I could see that.
I think more people are starting to loosen up. I think the more one has a created family experience, mm-hmm. where perhaps it is doesn't rely on nuclear family or even extended family, the more outsiders are allowed into your tribe celebration.
Yeah, Friendsgiving.
Exactly. Then the more expansive it can become culinarily.
And why do people eat Thanksgiving at 2 p.m.?
Because the football games.
And then like everyone's asleep. By
And then also you have to digest. It takes that long to digest.
I don't know. When I do Thanksgiving, it's always at a reasonable hour, 8 p.m., like normal people. We don't do like Thanksgiving lunch.
By that time, people are in bed with crumbs from their leftover turkey sandwich laying next to them.
Yeah, it's a weird day, isn't it?
Very weird. Hey, you know, sometimes for me, I feel like if I've never gotten out of my pajamas, I have like one Thanksgiving.
That's an amazing day. Now that's worth celebrating. That's something worth giving thanks for, if you ask me.
Well, I give thanks for you.
Likewise.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
That's Chef Sang-Yoon of Father's Office in Luxion. He's been taking aim at Thanksgiving's sacred cows, or should I say, turkeys. It's a subversive take on the holiday that he calls Sang-Giving. That's it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, you can listen to the show on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. You can also download our show wherever you get your podcasts. And a quick favor for you podcast listeners. KCRW wants to learn more about you, who you are, how you listen. So if you have 3 minutes to help us out, go to kcrw.com/survey. Thank you. As always, many thanks to the Good Food team, Nick Liao, Laurel Garcia, Rosalie Atkinson, Joseph Stone, Joel Stein, and Ronnie Mickelson. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.